WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest, Alan Arkin, starred in the films The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, Wait Until Dark, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Catch-22, The 7% Solution, The In-Laws, and Joshua Then and Now. As a director, he did the stage and screen versions of Jules Pfeiffer's Little Murders. Arkin recently directed an episode of Public TV's anthology comedy series Trying Times. It stars Gene Stapleton and Corey Feldman as two discontented people working at a fast food restaurant. The episode is called The Boss, and it will be shown in mid-November. Arkin also will co-star in a new film, Coup de Ville, which is scheduled to be released in March. Alan Arkin told me why he likes to work in different media.
I keep thinking that when I change media, something new and wonderful is going to happen, and I'm going to break through the limits of my own personality, and it never seems to happen. I look at my writing and I see the same kind of things I like about my acting and the same kind of things I dislike about my acting, and I feel like my direction has the same assets and liabilities as everything else I do.
Has that been one of the difficult things about performing, learning to figure out and then to accept what your limitations are?
Yeah, I never realized that until recently, but I think that, well, for me, one of the goals is to be something more than what I am, and no matter how far afield I think I'm going, in retrospect, I look back and all I see is me. Even no matter how many hats I change, no matter how many limps I affect or speech patterns I change, I almost invariably only see me. There have been a couple of times when I feel like I've transcended my own identity, and those were really enormously exciting times for me.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with seeing yourself in a role, though?
That's not the idea of doing it. I think originally that is. People want to perform initially because they want to be seen. Hey, look at me. Look what I'm doing. But then once in a while you reach something. I've been lecturing on this for the past year or two, on this very idea. You reach something in, and it's not just performing, it's almost any field, which is a kind of a epiphany where you're no longer there. And I achieved that for the first time when I was about 19 or 20, and when I had been studying acting fervently, and I wasn't on stage for about 20 minutes. I disappeared, and it's as if I was watching myself play the character, and it was the most exhilarating thing I'd ever experienced up until that time. And for the next 20 years or so, I became a junkie to that experience. Athletes have that experience. They have a term for it now. It's called being in the zone. When they do things they can't do, when they run faster than they can run, when they're impossible to catch on a football field, when they can hit a ball faster and harder than they've ever been done before in tennis. And it comes from really honing down your craft and letting yourself completely go. And then this thing takes over. And once you've experienced that, nothing else will satisfy you anymore. And once you've had that feeling, you can see in looking back at it that you've had this feeling. I mean, like in the performances that I've done where I've been, in quotes, in the zone, I can see that. I can see that I've literally disappeared and the character is there playing me. And once having had that feeling, you don't settle for anything else anymore.
Do you think that the impulse to act comes in part from wanting to get out of yourself, transcend yourself?
Oh, yeah, I think for a lot of people. I don't think they phrase it that poetically initially. I think it a lot of times comes out of a kind of self-loathing that a lot of people aren't really aware of at the time, wanting to be any. It certainly was in me, and I see it in the work of a lot of other people too, a desire to be anybody else but who you are. It also can come out of a kind of a childish thing of imitating other people, wanting to be, you know, seeing your father and imitating him, seeing other people around that look interesting, as if they have interesting attributes you want to adopt and affect. I think that's another way.
Well, who are those people around you who had mannerisms that you adapted when you were young and really impressionable?
It was endless. I used to imitate people on the street. I used to imitate actors that I saw. I used to imitate family members. I used to watch people's behavior in terms of how affected I was from an acting standpoint. So real life became fodder for for acting for me, which I think helped my acting, but didn't do my life any good particularly.
So even Thanksgiving dinner was, you'd be there watching how everybody was behaving?
Yeah, how did this person eat? Why am I moved when somebody says something in that way? And why can somebody else say almost the same thing and I'm not moved by them? It doesn't affect me. I was really caught up in that from a very early age on, from the age of 6, 7, 8.
Alan Arkin is my guest, and you could see a new episode of Trying Times that he directed. The episode's called The Boss, and it will be on in mid-November on public television. When you were growing up, was there anyone in your family or in your neighborhood who was theatrical in the way they lived their life? I don't mean that they were necessarily on the stage, but they had this sense of the theater of life.
Yeah, oh, very much so. There was a guy named Sam Kennedy, who was the husband of my mother's best friend, who was the most flamboyant character I'd ever met. He was right out of Sean O'Casey. He wore black turtleneck sweaters, woolen ones, without any underwear underneath, and jeans in days when nobody was doing things like that, in the 40s and late 30s. And he was about 6'4" and had a mustache and was a merchant seaman and a sculptor and a guitarist and drank like a fish. And he was the most flamboyant person I think I'd ever met. And
you like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was very organic. There was nothing artificial about it. It came right from the heart of him.
And any really colorful speakers?
Speakers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, him, my father was always very good verbally, and my grandfather was made speeches for the Masons, so he was very literate. I have a vivid memory of him reading a speech, tears streaming down his face, to a plumber who was, the two of them were in the bathroom, and the plumber, all you could see was his feet sticking out from under the bathtub. He was paying absolutely no attention to my grandfather. And there he was reading this passionate speech with tears streaming down his face.
So here you were with all of this interest in theater. And when you got, I think it was when you got out of college in around 1956, you were part of the pop folk group, The Terriers.
Yeah.
And they had a hit that made it onto the charts, actually, of the Banana Boat song and what, Cindy O' Cindy?
Yeah.
It seems, it almost seems like you were miscast in that group.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I felt so myself. I ended up after about 2 years being on stage at the Olympia Theater in Paris to an audience of about 3,000. We were singing our hearts out, and I looked down at myself, and there I was in black satin pants and a sport shirt open to my navel practically. And I said, who am I? What am I doing here? And I quit that night and went back to what I wanted to do, which was be connected with film and theater.
How did you get into the detour of folk music to begin with?
Well, I had gotten out of college, and I had gotten married and had a small child at the age of 22, and I needed something to do to just get us going. And there was this group that started, and I thought it would only take up my weekends periodically, and we'd make a little spare change to just survive on it. And within 3 months, we had an enormous hit on our hands, and so we traveled around the world with that for about 2 years, and it just seemed to me that it was the logical thing to do at the time. And I also thought, in my naive fashion, that would be an entree into film and theater, which it wasn't.
Well, I think one of your entrees into film and theater was Chicago's Second City group.
Yeah, it was my entree into everything.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I got born there.
Second City was an improvisational theater and comedy group. Were you surprised that you were good at improvisation?
Very, yeah. I had no idea I had any abilities in that area at all. In fact, it took me months to be funny. I would work out with David Shepard in the group, and I wasn't funny. Nothing I did was funny. And then finally, I hit upon one character that was funny. So I just played that character for a long time. No matter what I did as that character, people laughed. And so I said, well, I'll stick with that.
What was the character?
I don't remember. It was one ethnic type or another. I don't remember exactly who it was. But then I started adding to that character. I started adding other characters to that character, and I ended up with a library of characters that I played, each of which I felt were very far from what I was as a person, only to find out 10 years later and looking back that they were all exactly like me, every one of them.
Who were some of the characters?
Well, I had a Puerto Rican kid, a sensitive Puerto Rican kid who considered himself unable to do anything in society, played guitar. I had an ancient Jewish pretzel vendor who was modeled after my grandfather. I had an Italian laborer. I had a Chinese chef. That was the first four, I think. But I tried to use them in everything. I tried to squeeze them in every conceivable kind of place because they were the only things I felt comfortable with for a long time.
So at what point were you ready to like leave those characters aside and play comedy yourself?
Well, it was a long time. It really started when Mike Nichols cast me as Yossarian in Catch 22, and I kept looking at the character and looking at it, and I said, well, I finally asked him, who do I play him like? Who is he? Who should I model him after? He said, he's you. Mike said, he's you. And I thought to myself, what does he mean, me? There isn't any me. There's going to be a blank on the screen if I just do me. Nobody will show up. And he finally convinced me that I just had to be myself in that situation. And I had great trepidation about it. I didn't know how to do that. But I tried it, and I went to the dailies for a week or two with a lot of anxiety, thinking that there was going to be a blank hole in the screen where I was. And to my surprise, and finally I had to admit delight, there was somebody there. And I said, hey, there is a me. And I guess in most ways, that was a real transition for me, in seeing that I had an existence, that I did have some weight as myself, and that I could afford to let go of a lot of the places that I was hiding under.
Let's talk a little bit about your first feature film, The Russians Are Coming. Earlier you said that when you looked back on this role, you didn't feel like you saw yourself, you saw the character.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a short clip from the movie, and this is a scene from early on after the Russians have landed in New England, and you've knocked on the door of a family. Carl Reiner's the husband, Eva Marie Saint is the wife, and you're taking them at gunpoint into their home and hoping that they'll help you find a boat.
All the keeping calm, please. Yes. I repeat, no harm is coming. All now, please, being seated.
It's all right, honey, just take it easy now. Pete, boy, don't be scared. There's no need to be scared.
I'm not scared.
Good. Good boy. Now, to answer some few questions very quickly, please. So that there is no necessity whatsoever, why everybody in such a nice American family should get shot to little pieces. You understand? Yes. Good. Now, what else people are in this house?
So that's your first feature role.
Right.
What stage were you in acting then? How did you prepare for that role?
How did I prepare? It was mostly in learning how to speak Russian and thinking a lot about what I wanted to do. I didn't do any research because I didn't know how I could do any research. I wanted to be very comfortable. It was important to be comfortable. It was my first feature, and I knew I was going to be panic-stricken because it's something I'd wanted to do for 25 years, and it was just too big a hunk of my life to relax about.
So you actually studied Russian for the part?
Yeah, for months. I studied Russian with an old woman in New York. Nobody had told me what to do or how to do it. I was left to my own devices, so I worked for months with this woman trying to get the sound. And I was pretty good at languages, but there were sounds in Russian I could not hear. And then finally, after several months, I began to hear the sounds and I got the lines down in Russian. I went on the set and I said my first line in rehearsals proudly. And there were a lot of real Russians on the set. Nobody understood a word I was saying. And it turned out I was speaking a Russian that no one had spoken for about 50 years. It was totally archaic, and I had to, on the set, start over again from the very beginning, which was very unnerving.
So how much of the Russian do you remember?
I can still say my lines. You can wake me up in the middle of the night, and I can do my lines verbatim, and I can't do it with any other film.
But can you talk to a Russian?
I can say my lines to him from the film.
I'm sure that's a real help.
Yeah.
Alan Arkin, let's jump ahead to 1985, to your role in the movie Joshua Then and Now. And you starred along with James Woods in this movie. You played James Woods' father, a small-time Jewish gangster and bootlegger. And I want to play an excerpt from a flashback scene in which you're in a gym with your young son and you're teaching him about the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
What do we got here? Quote, thou shalt have no other gods before me, unquote. Yeah, you see, there was a lot of contenders in those days. Other gods, mainly no account of idols, bums of the month, until our God, Jehovah, came in and took the title outright. He made a covenant with our people.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, where was I? Yeah, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's... Thou shalt not steal.
Thou shalt not steal?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, there's 10 commandments. It's like an exam, right? I figure you get 8 out of 10 right, you're pretty much at the top of the class, aren't you?
Was there anyone you knew in life that you could pattern this character
on? Not a soul. No, nobody I knew. I loved that character. The minute I read the script, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with him. And that was it. I told Ted Kotcheff, the director, who was wonderful to work with, I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, fine, go ahead, that sounds good, and that's what I did. I worked out a lot. I got myself in pretty good shape for it, and in scenes they never ended up using. So I got into good shape for nothing. For nothing.
What a waste of time.
Yeah, it was terrible.
I have read about you that in the late 60s or early 70s that you started yoga and also found someone who was something of a guru figure for you.
Mm-hmm.
What brought about that change?
What brought about the change was 7 years of analysis in which I worked very hard and which I feel like I really needed. I was very unhappy. And I came to a point where I was coming to the end of my analysis by both my doctor's recognition and my own, and feeling like I'd passed the course, and having him say akin to, I never promised you a rose garden. And I found myself getting furious at that idea. Because I saw that there were people that had rose gardens, and I wanted one. And if analysis wasn't going to do it for me, particularly since I had worked very, very hard at it and had accomplished a lot of what my doctor felt was to be accomplished from it, I felt like I had to look elsewhere. And I started working with somebody who turned out, who I knew immediately was the best person I had ever met. He was the wisest and kindest person I'd ever met. And initially, I didn't know he was a yogi. He was my stand-in on a film, on Poppy. And
he was playing an extra? He was playing a stand-in.
He was my stand-in, which is not a terribly exalted job, as mm-hmm. everybody knows. And after about 3.5 weeks, I could sense very clearly that he was the center of the entire film. It's not as if he was loud or pushy or taking over anything, but he just radiated something that people gravitated towards. Like one person would be telling him their problems, another person would be asking him for a massage, and I got really quietly enraged by that. And it was, again, nothing that he was attempting to do. He wasn't attempting to run the show in any way. It was very quiet, and if you didn't really look for this, you wouldn't have even noticed it. And it annoyed me, so I said, here I am, I have everything, I'm the star, I got 10 times as much money as he's got, I got more attention, and he's the center of this thing. It's not right. So I tried to find out who and what he was, and he finally revealed the fact that he was Guru has got a terribly convoluted connotations this day. We've twisted around and almost destroyed the meaning of that word. Everybody who knows something is now called a guru, which is not what the word means by any stretch of the imagination. It means slayer of darkness, which is ultimately what analysis tries to do and doesn't do. It knocks off a piece of it, but it doesn't get the whole thing. And a great spiritual teacher knocks off your darkness, which is the thing that is keeping you from functioning fully and wholly and completely and lovingly.
Can I relate this back to acting and ask you if it's changed the way you act or changed how much you act or the kinds of roles you take?
Yeah, to a degree. It depends on how much money I've got in the bank, in part. I mean,
sure.
If I'm feeling pretty flushed, then I feel more comfortable in turning down things that I don't want to do. But if I'm behind a payment on the house, then I got to be a little bit more generous in my assessment of something. But yeah, I don't want to play horrible people anymore. I don't want to. It's no fun. There was a time when I had so little sense of myself that getting out of my skin and being anybody else was a sigh of relief. But I kind of like myself now a lot of the times, and I don't see any real necessity or value in playing people that I find abhorrent anymore. That's number one. And number two, I like to think if I possibly can be in situations like it, I want my work to be connected with things that somehow serve people in some way.
Would you like to be working as much as possible or as little as possible?
I don't know. It depends on the project. I did a film in June that was a wonderful experience in every way. It's coming out in March. I'm starting another film next month, a Robert Redford film that we're doing in the West Indies. And that makes me very happy. I love working when it's with people that I'm excited about working with, and it's when it's with projects that are have some redeeming feature about them. Otherwise, I'm just as happy to stay home and write or do nothing. I don't feel a burning need that I've got to act anymore or direct.
What do you do when you're doing nothing?
I'm thinking about writing when I'm doing nothing.
That's what a lot of writers do, is think about writing.
Yeah, right.
Well, Alan Arkin, I thank you so much for talking.
Thank you.
With us.
You're wonderful to talk to.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed this very much.
You're very easy.